Okay, I guess we're ready to begin. You already saw on the program that my name is Romaine Stauffer, and that, yes, that's my real name. And somebody asked me one time where I got my name, and I said, well, my mother gave it to me. Although my last name was a result of a choice I made myself 51 years ago. And I have always enjoyed reading and writing, and I've been writing for CLP since sometime in the 1970s, so that's a little where I come from. Our topic is authentically portraying a historical era. I remember the first time that I read The Long Winter by Laura Ingalls Wilder. You probably all read that book too. And it was so real. I was there with Laura. I heard the wind howling and the snow scouring the windows. And, you know, I was there. And I had a cultural shock when I put the book down, and it was summer. Because it was so real. I woke up in a completely different world than the one I had been living in when I was reading. So writing a story in a historical period is one of the hardest kinds of writing to do successfully. It takes an incredible amount of research to authentically portray a character living in a different time or even a specific moment. And so the goal is to do what Laura did, to draw the reader into the story and connect in a way that is, they feel like they are there with the characters in the book. So the questions we're going to be looking at in this workshop are, does the story open a window to a time the reader did not know about before, or bring a fresh perspective on a subject that people are familiar with? Is there enough detail in the setting to create an image in the reader's mind? Are the characters realistic and lifelike? Is the dialogue authentic to the period? Does the story transcend time and place so that it feels like it's happening as it is read? So since this is a Mennonite Writers Conference, and most of us will be writing about and for Mennonites, much of what I will say will be slanted in that direction. You're unlikely to write a story about the Inquisition or the French Revolution or something like that, so there's no point in going into that kind of thing. So we'll start with opening a window. Does the story open a window to a time the reader did not know about before, or bring a fresh perspective on a subject that people are familiar with? History was my favorite subject in school. I don't know which I liked best, reading or history, but history was my favorite subject. And not everybody enjoys history. But if you do a good job of writing a story with a setting in history, people that are not history buffs will enjoy it because they can handle small doses if it's in story form. And if your story is well written, they'll keep reading and they'll learn things that they didn't know before. So there are thousands of years to pick from in writing a historical story. You can pick anything from Genesis to the 1900s, anywhere in the world. So, but choose something that you are reasonably familiar with. I learned the hard way how difficult it is to write a story that is about something that happened in another country. I was asked to write a story about a missionary in Africa, and I struggled with that for 2 years. And then I finally decided I can't do this, because I don't know enough about Africa, and I couldn't portray it realistically. And so I gave up. And after that miscarriage, I knew when somebody asked me to write a story that took place in Denmark in World War II, I said, no thanks. I can't do that. I don't know much about Denmark. I don't know enough to write a story about that. Your story does not have to be about a Mennonite. But if it is, choose something that's not well known. Some stories like the Union attack on the Hostetlers in 1757 have already been written by several authors. Some are better than others. Some their imagination ran away with them. Open a new window, something that hasn't been overworked. Maybe you could write a story about old Indian Toby, who died in 1802 and spoke Pennsylvania German. Now, how did that happen? That was his story. That would be something that I don't think anybody has ever written. Sharon Yoder's book in the Conqueror series brings a fresh perspective to a well-known story of the sinking of the Titanic. Annie Funk was a Mennonite missionary, and she was returning home on the Titanic, and she gave her seat on a lifeboat to a mother that had children and then lost her own life in the icy water. Now, most of the books that are written on the Titanic talk about how that accident happened and the tragic loss of many lives. Sharon's book gives us a different perspective. Her focus is on serving others regardless of the cost. That is an example of a fresh perspective on a well-known story. So it can be done. There were a lot of books written about the Revolutionary War, but how many are about Mennonites in story form? A few have been popping up in the last couple of years, and I think that's good because the majority of our people don't really know the dilemma that our ancestors were in the Revolutionary War. They believed it was their duty to obey the government, and they had also promised to be loyal to the king when they immigrated or were naturalized. And then they were ordered by this government that had risen up in rebellion to renounce the king and swear allegiance to them. Well, they couldn't do it for a couple different reasons. And so, which was the legitimate government? Which one should they obey? How should they respond? And knowing what they went through during that time can give us a new insight and appreciation for what our ancestors went through during that time. All right, then let's look a little at setting. Is there enough detail in the setting to create an image in the reader's mind? The best way to know how to describe a setting in your story is to put your feet on the ground in that place. What do you hear, see, smell? But there's some problems with that. Suppose you want to write a story about something that happened in Harrisonburg in 1880. So you go to Harrisonburg, what you see, hear, and smell today is not what was there in 1880. So how can you know what Harrisonburg was like in 1880? I have three ways. Point. It takes a lot of research to write a historical story, and it makes all the difference in how deeply the readers can nest themselves in the story. Ironically, though, research is like an iceberg. Most of it is below the surface and invisible to the readers. They should not know that how long the writer had to research to know the difference between apple pie 200 years ago and apple pie today. The first thing you do, number one, the first thing you need to do is to be sure that you have your facts straight. Inaccuracies in a historical story damages its credibility. Read biographies and autobiographies of the people who lived during the time you're writing about. These will be full of little tidbits that can make your own writing sparkle. And if you're writing about a real person, make sure you know the facts of your character's life. The story of Peter Miller, who printed the Martyr's Mirror at the Effort of Cloister, that is well known. But with all due respect, Elsie Singmaster's book contains some glaring inaccuracies. The people who lived at the cloister did not immigrate as an organized group fleeing persecution in Europe. They split off the Brethren over the issue of the Sabbath worship after they were in Lancaster County. And Peter Miller did not arrive in Pennsylvania as Brethren and not with his family. He was a highly educated, ordained, single minister in the Reformed Church in Berks County. And the church where he preached is right next to where I live. So it's local history to me. And Peter joined the cloister in Lancaster County after he heard Conrad Boisel preaching in my neighborhood. And the soldiers that took the unbound copies of the Martyr's Mirror came in broad daylight, not at night. Now, Elsie Singmaster did write about the cloister, but she was not a historian, and she died in 1958. So I don't know how that book was written in 2018. Make sure you have your facts straight. History does not change, but what we know about it may change. And following what I'm saying about Elsie Singmaster, I will say my first book, Hidden Riches, was published in 1983, and I wrote it according to what we had been told and believed for at least 60 years, that Christian Burkholder was the son of Christian and Elizabeth, who migrated from Switzerland to Gerolsheim, Germany. And that book was published in 1983. In 1990, tax lists surfaced in Switzerland that totally changed the story. There was a Burkholder family in Gerolsheim, but that was not our family. Christian's parents were Ulrich and Barbara, not Christian and Elizabeth. Ulrich died in Switzerland. Barbara crossed the ocean with her six children in 1754. The problem with Hidden Riches was it was written based on secondary information instead of primary sources. Secondary sources are not gospel. Someone assumed that the Burkholder family in Gerolsheim was Christian's family and wrote that. And everybody after that copied that, wrote the same thing, and it was repeated in so many books that we believed it and didn't check. We didn't go to Europe to look for the proof. So it is true that the widow and six children arrived in Philadelphia on October the 1st, 1754, and they settled in Lancaster County, and from there on, the facts are right, but the European part is not. And I say all that to say I have made mistakes too. Do the best you can, but be aware that things may be found to change what we thought we knew. Again, history doesn't change, but what we know about it can change. So how can you find facts? Well, read primary sources, letters, diaries, newspapers, legal documents. Letters may not always be available, but they can contain valuable information. I had a great uncle who was the black sheep of the family, and he went to California, and he was married and divorced three times, and nobody could tell me much about him. And then one day, somebody was cleaning out her mother's attic, and came across a pack of letters that he had written to his sister. And she hated to throw them away, but she didn't know what to do with them. And so she asked me if I would like them. Well, sure, I want those letters. And so I read them, and in reading them, I was able to find clues to track his marriages, and he had children with each of his three wives. And then I took another chance, and I tracked down one of those grandchildren and contacted her. She was in Colorado, and she had been born a Burkholder, but she had never met another Burkholder. And she was really pleased with what I could tell her about the Burkholders, where she came from. So letters can have valuable information. And the same is true of diaries, but they may not always be available, but they can contain valuable information if you're fortunate enough to have them. They can not only confirm when something happened, but they can provide insight into the way people talked or thought. I have some copies of some pages from my husband's great-grandmother's diary. And she wrote that she was making what was she making?
Jelly.
And I looked at that, and she spoke Pennsylvania German, but she was writing in English, so she wrote it the way it sounded when she said it, and she was making chili. So, and she got her V's and W's mixed up too. She went to visit somebody. So it gives you a flavor of how they talked and what was going on in their lives and what they thought about it. Newspapers are a good resource. If you want an exact date, an accurate description of an event, my dad always said that they had three fires on their farm in one summer when he was boy. So what year? What order were the fires? They lived near New Holland, so I got the New Holland Clarion and looked it up. And I found it was in 1933. I found the dates of all three fires and a lot of other information. The articles on the fires told me the cause of the fire, what time of day it happened, what burned, the amount of the loss, which fire companies came, and one of them even said which way the wind was blowing. It said, because the wind was blowing this direction, you know, the other buildings weren't in danger. So newspaper journalists pack a lot of information in a small space. So you can glean a lot of information from a newspaper article.
How do you get that information? Like, can you go into the newspaper office and it's there? Is there anything available online?
Yeah, it's available online.
I have a little problem finding that.
Oh, well, I can tell you then. you can also find a lot of information in obituaries, but in the 1800s, they don't have as much information as obituaries do today, and they may not exist at all. Marriage licenses and death certificates are another good place to look for information. You can learn when and where people were married, who their parents were, who performed the ceremony. But marriage licenses are not available until the 1880s. So before that, you'll have to try find marriage records in church records or family Bible records. Death certificates will give you a person's birth and death dates, the names of their parents, the cause of death, and where they're buried, and other information sometimes. But again, they only begin in 1906. And in some states, they're sealed. Now, in the last few years, Pennsylvania did genealogists and horse historians a great favor when they put death certificates online. So some states have them, some don't. You have to find out what's available where you live. Deeds and land records are also good sources of information. They can help you define the boundaries of a property. They tell you who the land owners were, the date it was purchased, the name of the seller, the price paid, and other details. This winter, I found a deed. It's very interesting. It was a detailed agreement how the water from a certain spring would be divided by two men in the, you know, that lived next to it in the late 1700s. And they agreed to share the water privileges and maintenance of the dam and waterworks. And then one man would have the use of the water 4 days a week, and the other one would have it for 3 days. And the second man was permitted to pipe the water underground in 2-inch diameter tubes from the spring house to his property. So it was a very detailed, there was more than that in there. There was lots of details how this is going to be done. Legal documents can be searched for historical information. You can find these and many other records in the county courthouse. When I was writing about the warehouse, the fires in Annie's Day of Light, I asked if I could see, it was determined that it was arson. And so I went to the courthouse and asked if I could see the records from that trial. And they said, they gave me an index to look up. I knew the date of the fire. So they gave me an index and I looked it up and I said, this is the one I want to see. And the clerk said, well, give us a couple days to dig it out and we'll let you know. And so when they called me, I went down to the courthouse again. And I went into a room there and was handed the file with everything in it, all the records of the trial. I was not allowed to leave the room, but I could look at everything that was in there and make copies of whatever I wanted, as long as I liked. And that gave me a lot of information on the trial and the outcome. So things are available, but you have to know where to look. And if you don't know, you have to look until you find where to look. The United States Census is another helpful source of information. The problem with them is before 1850, they only give the name of the head of the household. It doesn't list the names of the women and children. So that's kind of makes it hard to know who the wife and children were, since only their names and gender are given. If you know the family, sometimes you can figure it out. Historical societies have a wealth of information, and they might have microfilms of tax records, wills, and things like that that can save you a trip to the courthouse. And they have a lot of books on many subjects and old photographs. One day, I work at the Lancaster Mennonite Historical Society as a volunteer. And one day when I was in there, a man came in and he was looking for a picture of a mill that no longer exists. And then I remembered I had just gotten finished getting there was a man who had gone around and taken pictures of all the mills, and he had it in a scrapbook and he had donated it to the Historical Society. And I remembered I had just finished getting that ready for the archives. And so we went and got it, and he found a picture of the mill he was looking for, and he walked out of there on air because he was looking for it for a long time. Gravestones are considered a primary source. They are usually accurate, but I have, on occasion, found a few mistakes on gravestones. The internet is a great asset for research if you have access to it. A lot of the things I just mentioned can be found online. More and more things are being made available online. And so if you looked and didn't find it, wait a couple years and maybe you can find it. That happened to me one time. I was trying to locate a property in Texas and couldn't find it, and I gave up. And then a few years later, my husband said, well, you find other deeds online. Why don't you try? And so I went to a place I'd never been before And I thought, well, I'll start at the bottom county of Texas and work my way up, see if I can find it. And so I started at the bottom county and clicked on it, and right there it popped up. And for $3, they send it to me by email. So just because you didn't find it the first time, maybe you can find it again if you look a little later. More things might be on. Find a Grave is a website that has a lot of photos of gravestones. And so if you use Find a Grave, you can see pictures of gravestones anywhere from here to Oregon without going there. So that, and in Canada too. So newspapers, death certificates, wills, deeds, many other things can be found online. So find out what's available in your area and use it. Look at pictures from the years you're writing about. They can guide you on clothing styles, the appearances of towns, houses, kitchens, farms. You don't need to write long descriptions of everything you're writing about, but you need to know as much as you can so that you can picture it in your mind as you write and weave accurate details into your story. Look at maps, atlases, get a sense of direction. Where did your main characters live? Who were their neighbors? How far was it to town? What roads existed at that time? And bridges? Was there a railroad or a trolley? All these questions you need to answer so that you can accurately describe the setting. Take care with plants and trees. Some things that may be common to you are not here all that long. Don't have your colonial plantations crepe myrtle blooming in the spring. Crepe myrtle wasn't introduced into America until the early 19th century, and it blooms in the summer. So be careful with that kind of thing. If you have someone writing a letter before 1812, they cannot write with a pencil because pencils weren't invented until 1812. Most people wouldn't pick that up, but somebody that knows their history, knows more about history than you do, might pick that up and say, well, that wasn't possible. And a person in the 1700s shouldn't be found wishing there was something like a telephone so they wouldn't have to write a letter. They could not, if you do something like that, you're writing history in reverse. They could not have imagined a telephone any more than I could have imagined email when I was a teenager. It has to be typical for their period. Houses and kitchens and farms were different in different eras. Some generations might have lived in the same house for multiple generations, but the house would change in each generation. It could change. And so you'll have to have a good understanding of the customs at the time. And that's going to vary with your characters and their nationality. If they're Welsh, they're going to eat different foods than Germans. And how they eat might be different. Here's a line from The Trail of the Conestoga by Mabel Dunham. She says, at one point, this is just one sentence, she says, he shoved his food into his mouth at the end of his knife. Now that is an excellent example of authentic historical writing, because Germans ate with a knife that was dull but had a flat blade. They ate with their knife. And I don't know how they eat peas with knife, but I thought, well, I guess if Orientals can eat rice with two sticks, they knew how to eat peas on a knife. And I don't have this in my notes, but a couple of weeks ago, we went to an Amish service, and after the service, they served lunch, and they gave me a knife. That was all. I mean, I had a plate, but I eat with a knife. It can be done. I watched how they did it, and then I did it too. My grandmother had, I have it, it's a fancy glass, looks sort of like a pitcher. It has a handle on each side. It was a spoon holder. And when she had company, she put the spoons in that spoon holder in the center of the table. She did not put one at each place. But spoons were available in case anybody needed one. So, you know, different times, little details like that will help to make your story authentic. And it takes a lot of time to dig out those little details to make it authentic. I read a few of Jeanette Oak's books years ago because I like anything with historical setting. And I was reading one of these books, and I was shocked when I found that she had brocade drapes and a tea cart in a log cabin. That was so badly misplaced, I never read another Jeanette Oak book. If the setting is not authentic, the credibility of the whole story is damaged. And this is especially important if you're writing about somebody who actually lived. Now, regardless how long ago your main character lived, accuracy and authenticity is of the historical setting are absolutely essential. And that doesn't just apply to the physical setting. The worldview of the characters, their values, their morals, must accurately reflect their era in which they lived. The first 200 years of Anabaptist history, our forefathers had a suffering theology. They believed that suffering was the mark of genuine faith, based on the verse, "All who live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer persecution." But then after the Mennonites were in America and persecution stopped, their suffering theology was replaced with the humility theology. Humility, obedience, simplicity, hospitality, honesty, consistency. Those are the hallmarks of traditional Mennonite value system that integrates salvation and ethics in a seamless web. By their fruits, you shall know them. Was based on that verse. And I'm still trying to decide what one word you would use to describe Anabaptist theology from 1930 to now. If anybody has an answer for that, I'd like to know. I think we've, by and large, the Mennonite Church has lost the humility theology. Humility was highly guarded during the second 200 years of Mennonite history. That would be from 1725 to 1925. My great-great-grandfather thought that wearing false teeth was a show of pride. And he finally compromised by saying it's all right to wear them to eat, but then you take them out till the next meal. So, yeah, and one lady that I worked with on her family history, she had a hard time accepting it that her ancestor in Lancaster County had a still in the 1700s. But that was common in colonial days, and they had no conscience against it. It was the way they took their grain to market. They turned it into whiskey first because they could carry more that way than if they took the actual grain. Later on, that became taboo, and they switched to raising tobacco, which really wasn't a whole lot better. But to be authentic to the period, you must show their thinking at the time, not what we think today. And so truly great historical writing provides more than a glimpse into the past. It also provides insight into their situations and ways of thinking. Visit a museum or a living history event that pertains to your era. Study authentic clothing, furniture, decorative items, tools, weapons, art. You will have to go to a Mennonite museum to see Mennonite clothing, and depending where you live, that may not be possible. But look at pictures. If you can't go to a museum, look at pictures. And you can often identify the time period by the clothing, the way they're dressed. Originally, a Mennonite cape hung out over the shoulders, much like the German Baptist Brethren still wear it. It was one that hung over the shoulders. And later, they were stopped right here at the shoulder seam, like ours do today. But they had 2 points in the front and 1 point in the back. And these front points were loose. And later on, they started to tuck them into the apron belt. And then later on, they started to sew the cape, made it straight across, and sewed it to the belt. And then in the 1920s, in the flapper era, capes were long-waisted. They followed the styles and made their capes long-waisted. But then they came back up again, and eventually you have the capes we make them today. So you can... you need to have your people dressed in the right style of clothing, because Mennonite clothes did change, just like others did. There are one of the earliest known statements on women's clothing in the Lancaster Conference was found in a 1763 Bible used in the Grofdale Meeting House. And that statement said that all women's clothing, woolen clothing, should be made from gray cloth, and that linen clothing should be white. Cotton, neckerchiefs, aprons, and stockings were to be white or light blue. So that was my source for this sentence in Loyalty Test. For just a second, Mem's white stockings showed as she lifted her long gray skirt to follow him across the threshold. You have to do a lot of research to write one sentence and find the right thing to make it authentic. Now, I haven't been able to find anybody who can tell me how Mennonites went from white to black, being considered the plainest color of stockings. If anybody knows, tell me. In the 1700s, women did not wear black dresses because black dye was expensive, and that would have been costly array. And so they wore a lot of brown and soft colors made from dyes of natural products. well, I'm going to run out of time. I think I'm going to have to cut some stuff. Furniture varies. You can find estate inventories, which will give you some tips on what people had and how they lived. Christian Burkholder died in 1809, and in his inventory it tells us he had pewter dishes and a copper kettle to make apple butter. So you can find those in archives of the county courthouse or a historical society. And living history museums and demonstrations are wonderful places to not only see old things, but to watch them being used, how they did spinning and baking in a bake oven, running a sawmill, plowing with horses, and all kinds of things. One time when I was riding, I needed to know how to hitch a horse to a buggy, so I got one of my husband's cousins who drives a buggy, I got him to hitch up his horse and tell me how to do it, and then I wrote the steps down. Okay, characters. Are your characters realistic and lifelike? You can write a paragraph in your first chapter describing your main character, but that's like handing somebody a whole bologna. You need to give it to them a slice at a time, and they should be smart enough to figure out what kind of person this is. Some of that has been discussed in other workshops. You can give your character a quirky habit. Maybe she always has a habit of twisting a lock of hair or something like that to help give them a character, add to their character. Your characters need to be realistic, but not too realistic. I read a book recently with a graphic description of a child eating something she got from her nose. That detail really was not necessary to tell the story. And remember the show and tell that we've been told all the time. Let's look at an example on your worksheet. Somebody want to read the first example there, starting with it. It was the winter of 1932. Go ahead.
It was the winter of 1932. As my mother cast a furtive glance through the kitchen window, she saw several men coming into the courtyard. They were activists, men who had earlier brought misfortune to a number of families. Among them was one of our neighbors. Mother and my sister Anna were washing clothes, and several pails and pots of snow were melting into water on the long bench behind the stove. I will never forget how both of them immediately stopped washing, grabbed bags of peas, beans, and grits from the wall shelf, and stuffed them into the pails and pots of melting snow. They packed the snow back into the pails, covering up the bags. Mother wanted to hide whatever possible from those men who could already be heard in the next room. 6 years old at the time and naturally curious, I followed the strangers to see what they would do. The men searched the entire house and took whatever they could find. Then they took crowbars and shovels and began digging through the barnyard and the dirt barn floor. Finding nothing new, they gave up and left the house with their loot. Minutes later, Mother and Anna took the bags of food out of the water and spread the contents over the kitchen table to dry. There was nothing else edible left in the house. The men had stripped our larder. Several days earlier, these activists had made an unexpected visit and taken Father away. They came early in the morning and I was still in bed.
Okay, now on your next sheet, somebody read the next little story.
Johann looked up when he heard Mother gasp. He saw her spin around from her wash tub and grab bags of peas and beans from the wall shelf. "Quick, Anna," Mother said in an urgent undertone. "Those men are coming back. We've got to hide our food." Fear grew in Johann's eyes as he saw Anna grab a bag of grits from the shelf. He was just 6 years old that day in 1932, but he knew what Mother meant by those men. They had come early one morning a few days ago and taken Father away. What would they do this time? Following Mother's example, Anna plunged the bag of grits into one of the pails of melting snow, setting on the long bench behind the stove. They were using the melted snow for wash water. The men were already in the next room by the time Anna had covered the bag with a mound of snow.
So what do we have there? We have two versions of the same story. What's the difference?
It's a showing, not telling.
Yeah. The first one is telling what happened. The second one is showing it. And you make your characters come alive by showing their actions and emotions, which was well covered in another workshop. Another difference is the first one lacked any dialogue. You can move the story along with dialogue. In the first one, they're just like wooden puppets on strings that jerk along, but they don't speak. And dialogue brings your characters to life. So the words must flow from page to page so the main character becomes a living person in the reader's mind.
Emotions in the second one.
Yeah, and your reader will not be moved to tears unless you have first been moved to tears when you're writing it. And to be authentic, your characters must fit their age. Junior readers like adventure and mystery, but too often those kinds of stories show them thinking and acting above their age level. I recently read a book about Marcus Whitman, who was a missionary to the Indians in Oregon. And in this story, his 12-year-old nephew goes along with him, and he pretty much takes over out there what was going on at the mission. And so books where junior-age children have all kinds of amazing adventures or live in their own can be as damaging to children of that age as romance novels are to young girls, because they plant unrealistic ideas into the minds of the readers. The names of your characters must fit where they live. If they're from Lancaster County, they're going to be Weaver or Martin or Sensnick or something like that. And if you're writing about Virginia, they're going to be Heat Waller, Show Waller, or names like that. But Miller is a generic name you can use anywhere. Dialogue. Is the dialogue authentic to the period? Unless you have diaries or journals to tell you exactly what people said, dialogue must be invented in a historical story. Use authentic language, but don't overdo it. I have an example here. From The Critters Go to the Barbecue by Uncle Remus and Br'er Rabbit. Now, we're not going to read this because my tongue is too Dutch to try to read this. But this is an example of being overdone. It is hard to read, unless you talk that way, I guess. That's hard to read. But you want to use, you want to keep your language modern and familiar for the ease of the reader, but slip in expressions and words to flavor the language without having to restructure the speech. Here's a good example by Judy Yoder from The Fields of Fish Creek. Mr. Lakes bowed just a bit and nodded, glad to oblige. Then he smiled. You'll find it not as dry here as in your corner of Oklahoma. Was the draught right smart where you came from? His hands kept passing his cap back and forth as he talked. Dad cleared his throat. Yeah, quite a few years. Well, you'll find it different here, I hope. Mr. Lakes pulled his cap back on. He chuckled as he reached for the door. You found the well, I guess. It does ride fair, as old as it is. Mr. Lakes nodded, turning to go. Suddenly he turned back. Of course, in the back side of the creek, it's right good soil. Black and rich, so I heard. He chuckled. Creek's called Fish Creek. Don't know, but your boys might want to look for minnows there. The door slammed shut, and Sanford and Eli looked at each other. Minnows? Eli thought, that would be fun. Ah, what good neighbors, Mom said, stopping long enough to smile. Now, you see, the dialogue is moving the story along, and it has a local flavor. It sounds just like somebody from Oklahoma talking. He says, right smart, right fair, and so forth. And then Mom and Dad are saying, ach and ya, you know, the way they would talk. So it's two cultures shown in this dialogue. So you'll be writing in English, but if your characters normally speak in another language, you'll want to sprinkle a few of those words in, put them in italics, just to remind the reader that these people aren't speaking English. Watch for misplaced words or phrases. Don't allow your colonial character to use words like weekend or awesome or a phrase like where the rubber meets the road. You know, they didn't have weekends and or rubber in colonial days, so that's misplaced. And also misplaced metaphors and similes. A fierce windstorm in Rome should not sound like an onrushing train, you know, back in Bible days. One English professor told about her novel in the Middle Ages where she had written, two characters lay in bed like spent matchsticks. And she caught the problem in the very last pass before it went to publication. Matches didn't exist till 1800. So those are a lot of things you need to watch for to be sure that you're not misplacing things in the years you're writing about. Realism. Does the story transcend time and place so that it feels like it's happening as it's read? I read Emily Steiner's book, two books, Under the Bridge and Under Fire, and they are examples of good Mennonite historical fiction. They're some of the most realistic Mennonite fiction I read in a long time. And there's a lot of violence in the first one, but in Under Fire. But the descriptions of the setting could only have been written by someone who is familiar with the area. And your characters come alive and your emotions are stirred as you read and understand their predicament. And even though there's a lot of violence in Under Fire, it's a story of based on things that actually happen and the labor problems that the miners had. But the message is woven through the story that violence breeds violence and non-resistance is a biblical way for a Christian to live. So if your story is about a real person, some imagination is needed to flesh out the bare bones of the story, but fact and fiction must be woven together so seamlessly that the reader can't tell the difference. After Aaron's Civil War was published, somebody asked me, how much is fact and how much is fiction? And I said, well, I can't give you a percentage. The basic storyline is fact. Some things were imagined, but I tried to use as much fact as possible. For example, the man who lives on the farm, I talked about building the barn, and the man who lives on that farm went out in the barn and counted how many hand-hewn beams are in that barn. And he also said where the best place was on the farm to find dandelion. Those are, you know, the reader, that's the bottom of the iceberg that the reader doesn't see, how I found out those things. But that makes it authentic. So when you're putting flesh on the bare bones of the story, you need to keep it true to life. If your imagination is too active, you'll have things that are too outlandish to be true and come across as fantasy. The answer to your character's knotty problem is not going to come floating through the air on a piece of paper. Truth can be stranger than fiction, and God does work miracles. But if the story depends on miracles to develop the plot, it's not credible. And in the end, everything works out perfectly. No, that's not credible. When I was writing Loyalty Test, I crafted a wonderful story of Christian loving his enemy and returning good for evil. And I had a historian friend read the manuscript, and he said to me, this is too obviously fiction, and it's going to damage the credibility of the story. And so it was painful, but I got out my scalpel and I sliced out that whole story, and it is not in the book. While historical authenticity is important, imagined elements of the story don't have to be based on fact. There's a wide variety of opinion how much artistic license a writer should be permitted with fictional components. For the actions and experiences of fictional characters, some would say the only limitation is the author's imagination. But for non-fictional events and people, the story must stay true to the historical record. The character's thinking, actions, and speech must fit her, his or her age at the time. A child or a teenager does not think or talk like an adult. And the words they might use must fit the time period and the location. For example, today in North America, you would say bi-weekly. But and sometimes in places, they would say fortnight. And a cemetery might be called a God's Acre longer ago. And what we call a car would be a horseless carriage. Or in the late 1800s, it would have been a horseless carriage. By 1930, at least where we live, cars were called machines. Everybody knew what a machine was. I remember when we got an answering machine for our phone, and we would say, we got this message on the machine. And then I thought, well, that's my grandmother called a car. So, cars were railroad cars. It took me a while to figure that out when I read about cars, that they're talking about railroad cars. Historical writing can be tricky to master. And if you haven't done your homework, it won't feel authentic. But on the other hand, nobody wants to read a story that feels like a school history lesson. So by now, you might be feeling overwhelmed with the amount of research that you have to do to write an authentic story. But don't try to know it all before you start writing. Learn as much as you can about what you're going to write about. But, you know, scientists solve a problem by writing down the answer first and then conducting the research to find out if that's true. And that's how historical writing is. You know what you want to write about, and you don't need to do a massive amount of specific research before you start. Establish your theme, your characters, your timeline, and then find out what you need to know to get started. And you can't know everything before you start, because as you write, questions will come up that you never thought of before. And so the research is continuing and interwoven with the writing. And just let me warn you, for every answer you find, you're going to have two more questions. One of the benefits of historical writing is your own education. You'll learn things that change your perspective on life and time, and you will begin to understand that not much has changed. People are still the same. Human nature is the same as it always was, and you'll start to see how fast time flies. And because human nature has not changed and we struggle with the same problems that people always did, that's why the Bible is applicable as much to us today as it was when it was written. So we can learn a lot from history, and we are not doomed to repeat it. So maybe 1 minute or two if anybody has a question. Well, if not, God bless you and inspire you as you write. The benefits are ours, the glory is His. Thank you.